Welcome to the Arbor Research and Trading and Bianco Research Conference Call. Your host for today's call is Mr. Jim Bianco, President of Bianco Research. Operator assistance is available at any time during this conference by pressing star zero. A question and answer session will follow the presentation. I would now like to turn the call over to Mr. Jim Bianco. Mr. Bianco, you may begin.
Thanks, Gene, and good morning. Thanks for everybody joining us on our conference call. Before I get into today's topic, my standard housekeeping, there is a handout, and hopefully you had no problem in downloading it. If you had a problem for any reason, you can send an email to Greg Blaha at gblaha@biancoresearch.com, and he'll turn around and send you an attached PDF of our handout. Okay, today's conference call is updating our outlook. In updating our outlook, I struggled a little bit with this topic, only in that my natural instinct is to talk about the yield curve and to talk about interest rates, and there's really not much going on there for the moment. They are sideways, and they look like they're going to continue to be sideways. So there's the forecast. The curve's at -2, and it will stay at -2. Yields on the 10-year are somewhere around 470, and they're going to stay around 470, give or take a few basis points. So what I decided to do was talk about things that are a little less uncertain, and that would be Fed policy, the stock market, fiscal policy, and international capital flows. So those are the topics that I want to try and touch today in roughly 20 minutes. So let's start on page 2. Page 2 page 2 is entitled, Greenspan is no longer Federal Reserve Chairman. This comes from a piece that we wrote last month, and I think it's an important distinction to be made. And basically what I say here on this piece is that Greenspan and Bernanke operate very differently when it comes to Federal Reserve policy, and that we should not confuse the two of them when putting together our forecasts or our beliefs about Federal Reserve policy. In summary, the Fed has a dual mandate: to keep both inflation as low as possible and to keep employment as high as possible. Sticking within that framework, Greenspan used to operate on the keep employment as high as possible. So he would conduct policy or would adjust policy any way he seemed necessary to instill confidence or to meet the economy's real growth move forward. Bernanke, on the other side, who is speaking right now in Chicago as I talk, is focusing on the keep inflation as low as possible. Bernanke's nomination speech was all about the need for inflation targeting. The Fed talks about core inflation, forecasts core inflation, and hopes they're right on data dependency. So in order to get the Fed to move rates, we are either going to need a move up or down in core inflation. Full stop, that's it, a move up or down in core inflation. Now, most of the analysis that I read about what the Fed should do or what the Fed will do is all premised on what I've been terming the Greenspan playbook, that the employment rate is doing this, non-farm payrolls are doing that, the stock market may be doing this, there may be this happening in China. So therefore, given any of those or some of those other things along those lines, the Fed needs to move rates up or down, mostly down is what you get from a lot of these. That's the way Greenspan operated. He is not the Fed chairman anymore. Bernanke operates very differently. And as we've talked about, it's now been 15 or 16 months into the Bernanke term, and Greenspan has cast such a big shadow on the Federal Reserve chairmanship that people have not yet begun to realize that the game has changed and that it is about inflation. If you want the Fed to ease, you need to make the case that there will be a rapid decline in the core inflation rate, or that the Fed will be so comfortable in forecasting a rapid decline in the core inflation rate that they will ease ahead of that. If you think the Fed is going to tighten, you need to make the case that the core inflation rate is going to stay at current levels or move higher, because the Fed has already said that it is uncomfortably high. What you don't need to discuss is the stock market, risk premiums, employment, consumer confidence or anything that Greenspan used to focus on, but yet that's exactly what everybody seems to be focusing on. So I think it's important to bring up that distinction that we have a new sheriff. He's operating under new rules. Those rules are consistent with the mandate of the Fed because they have a dual mandate, a unique central bank in that regard. And we need to focus on what Bernanke thinks is important, and then we can get an idea of where Federal Reserve policy is going to go. Now, on page 3, this is the second thing I want to bring up because this constantly keeps coming up, although I have tried to dissuade this now in this conference call and in many writings for the last few months. Predicting Federal Reserve policy. The chart on the right, the black line on the left, is the actual Fed funds rate, and the three colored lines, the green, red, and blue lines coming off of that, are the predicted path of the Fed funds futures rate on three different dates, January 29th, March 2nd, and 2 days ago, May 15th. January 29th, the blue line, was what the most hawkish date we've had this year, when the market did not expect the Fed to ease until 2008. March 2nd is the most dovish date that we've had this year, when the market expected the first ease to come in June. The red line, May 15th, is the current one, which is where the market expects it around October or November, as far as the first ease goes. Now, all of these lines are downward sloping, and I believe that this is coloring a lot of people's opinions. While the market thinks the Fed's going to ease, it's just a discussion of when the Fed is going to ease. As we point out in the bottom chart, the gray line there is the 17 rate hikes we saw, and then the flat horizontal part at the top is when the Fed held. The green, red, blue, cyan, and purple lines are what the predicted path of Federal Reserve policy on various dates over the last couple of years. The point is you could see that the market has a dovish bias. It always thinks the Fed's going to raise rates less than it actually does or pause sooner than they actually did. The Fed was actually more hawkish. Now, why is it that there's a dovish bias? And remember, I believe that this is clouding everybody's opinion, that the discussion has been, when will there be the next ease? And I'm asking, who said there's going to be a next ease in the marketplace? And a lot of times when I've asked that question, the thing is, look at Fed fund futures. They're always predicting one way off in the future. As I pointed out before, as one hedge fund manager asks, can you think of an event that would get the Fed to have an FOMC emergency meeting tomorrow? And I've answered yes. You had a stock market crash, a geopolitical event, a terrorist attack, or something along those lines, the Fed would meet in an emergency meeting tomorrow. What would the Fed do? They would probably ease off of such a crisis event. Can you think of any event that would cause the Fed to meet in an emergency meeting tomorrow to raise interest rates? The answer is that event does not exist. So there is an inherent dovish bias in the Fed fund futures that the unknown that we cannot foresee will only result in the Fed easing rates. There is no unknown that we cannot foresee that would cause them to raise rates. Hence, the built-in premium towards falling rates. That's why the market constantly is more dovish than they thought during the 17 rate hikes than it is now. So I've argued looking out beyond 3 months on Fed fund futures, you have to adjust for that dovish bias. And if you adjust for that dovish bias, what you'll find is that the market thinks the Fed's on hold for quite a long time. Now, page 4, why does the market think the Fed's on hold? Again, the Fed focuses on core inflation. Core inflation, by focusing on core inflation, you take some of the things in core inflation and you magnify their importance because you've taken food and energy out. And if the more things you take out, the more you magnify their importance of other things. We have argued that what is being magnified in the core inflation rate right now is owner's equivalent rent because it is something along the lines of 30% of core CPI and about 14% of core PCE. So as I wrote here, we do not think it's a stretch to say that implied rental values of homes matters more to the Federal Reserve than the price of gasoline when setting Fed policy. Now, as far as where we are, again, the top right chart, the blue bars are year-over-year change in OER, and the red line is the excess return of apartment REITs to total REITs shifted forward 6 months. So what's happening to apartment REITs relative to total REITs now, we believe is an excellent indicator of where OER is going to go in 6 months, and OER drives core inflation, which drives Fed policy. What you see is that red line has taken a big dive in recent months. It peaked on Halloween, October 31st, and it's gone down quite substantially. Although it started to rebound a little bit in the last couple of days, the fact is you should be looking for OER to start downward from here forward. If you look at the chart underneath it, that's exactly what's been happening, is that the blue line shows that OER is starting downward for the first time in quite a while. And that should bring the core inflation rate, which is the chart on the left, down back into the Fed's comfort range, which we are somewhat defining as about 1 to 2%. Maybe it's 2.25%, but it's going to bring it down. And if it brings it down, the Fed's on hold. The Fed is on hold throughout the balance of this year and into next year. If it brings it down substantially, then we could talk about easing. If it doesn't bring it down enough, or we're wrong and OER turns up, or core inflation just defies OER, the other components overwhelm it, then the Fed will react accordingly. That's what drives Fed policy. Okay, page five. Let's talk a little bit about the stock market, because I think that the stock market is probably the most interesting story out there right now. And the stock market story is about supply shrink. The chart on the left, upper left, shows the net issuance of equities through the first quarter from the Federal Reserve Flow of Funds report. In about 3 weeks, we'll get an update on this for Q1. I suspect it'll be a little bit larger. But you can see that we net reduced this float of the U.S. stock market by $400 billion in all of 2004 through the year ending in Q4 2006. That means that the combination of buybacks and companies going private shrunk the stock market by more than $400 billion when you add back to it secondary offerings and initial public offerings. As a percentage of the market's capitalization, the chart below it, you can see that we're at the most extreme level since the 1980s. The 1980s, as a percent of market cap, was a much bigger level. Now, what's interesting about this chart, especially the percent of market cap chart, is the returns in the stock market do line up very well with this chart. When the net issuance of equities as a percent of market cap is highly negative, negative 2, 3, 4, the market returns around 19% versus 11% for the entire period shown. When it's above 1%, like it was in the 1970s and the early 1990s, the market returns about 8%. So it's less than average when it's above 1%. It's better than average when it's around 2% or lower. And we're at 2% right now. So the idea here is that as the pool of stocks shrinks, the amount of money in the market stays the same, and that has to get reinvested back into an ever smaller pool of stocks. Now, what does that really mean? We wrote a piece about this a couple of weeks ago, and we said that stocks can be priced for one of two reasons. They can be priced for ownership. That's what we do. We own stocks. Or they can be priced for control. That's what Sam Zell and Rupert Murdoch do. They control companies. There's usually a premium for control. That's why mergers are done at a premium to current ownership prices. If the marketplace believes that this merger wave is going to be huge, they're going to start to price the entire market for control. The entire market cannot be bought. And at some point when it ends, we're going to have to go back to pricing all of these stocks for ownership, which is a fancy way of saying they will go down. By the way, I will throw out a very interesting statistic I heard yesterday. I haven't had a chance to confirm it, but I have no reason to believe it wrong, and it was from Jim Cramer on CNBC. He said that the amount of money in private equity right now is enough to buy and take private the 350 smallest companies in the S&P 500. So the bottom 350 companies could go private right now with the amount of money in private equity, according to Jim Cramer. Like I said, I haven't been able to confirm it, but I have no reason to believe that that's wrong. To give you an idea of how the mentality of this market is, that means that in this market's mind, all 350 of them should be priced for control. Does that mean they're all going to be bought and taken private? No, but that's the way that they're going to be priced, and that's why this market has gone up 10% in the first 6 months of this year. And as you can see on the chart on the right, the merger mania that we're talking about here, Here's a rolling three-month sum of announced M&A activity is at an a multi-year high right now. We don't have data back into the 80s. I can't say if it's an all-time high. Probably is on a nominal basis, but maybe on a percentage of market cap basis it isn't. But it is at least a several-year high. Again, on page six, I do want to point out that it is the merger thing that it seems to have caught the market's attention, although that's a dangerous game to play because when it ends, it usually ends badly. It's not necessarily that money is flying into the market. The chart on the bottom, again, shows the rolling 12-month sum of money into equity funds. Domestic equities are the bars. The red line is private equity. You can see we're negative for the first time since 2003. The public is not putting money into the stock market, even though it's up over 10% in the last 6 months. It's been up 10% in 2000 or more in 2006 and in 2005, and already halfway through 2007, they are not participating in this market. It's quite extraordinary to see the public not interested in the market. Mutual funds own 25% of the U.S. stock market, and that owner, that 25% owner, is not participating by adding more money to the market. It's just the big supply shrink that's taking the market higher. That supply shrink is looking like there's no signs of it slowing down right now, and so there's no reason to believe that the market is going to stop going up. Hence why we've only had a handful of down days this quarter, like six or seven of them, and yesterday's 100-point-plus up day is another one of those ho-hum kind of days that you see what else is new, the Dow's up 100, it's about as common as the sun going up, or at least that's the perception that we have in the marketplace. For the moment, I don't see that ending. But when it does end, I think it will be rather unpleasant. Page 7, the wealth effect. I do want to talk a little bit, if you're not a stock trader, again, that this is an important point to bring up, that the stock market so dominates things beyond just the stock market itself. The wealth effect, a chart on page 7 shows the stock market's capitalization as a percent of nominal GDP, and it shows that currently it's at 130%, 128.8%. Again, we have a $17.5 trillion stock market against a $13 trillion nominal GDP. I believe this is an important statistic to understand so that when you look at the charts on page 8, they make a little bit more sense. Let me start with the chart in the lower right on page 8. I'm surprised that this chart has not gotten more attention than it has, or this statistic. The federal surplus deficit, the federal deficit, which, according to political polls, the American public lists as the number one economic problem facing the country right now, is the large federal deficit, has collapsed in the last few months. Now, I'm showing it here on a year-over-year basis so that it incorporates all seasonality into the numbers because the revenues and the outflows are lumpy. They don't go in and out at the same time. So year-over-year incorporates it. We're down to, in April of 2007, $144 billion deficit from $209 in the year ending March of 2007, a $50 billion swing in 1 month. Thank you, capital gains, for flying into the Treasury, giving them on April 17th a $48 billion one-day inflow from just cashing all the checks that came in right at the end on tax day, and helping to take the deficit from an April of 2004, just 3 years earlier, $455 billion to $145 billion. We've shrunk the deficit by $300 billion. And yet, if anybody's been watching politics, they know we've been spending a lot of money in Iraq. We've been spending a lot of money in cleaning up after Hurricane Katrina. And a lot of conservatives are crying that Congress has an inability to rein in spending. Even after all of that, the deficit has gone from $455 billion to $145 billion. It's within shouting distance of being balanced before the election. Now, why is that? Look at the chart above. It shows capital gains as a percent of all income. And the data is only current through 2005 because that's the last data we have. We won't get the 2006 data probably until early part of next year. But what it shows is that since the 1986 Tax Act, there's been an 80% correlation between the deficit and capital gains. Right now, the average taxpayers, 8% of the average taxpayers' adjusted gross income is due to capital gains. If you look at the chart on the right, basically what it shows is that total capital gains on the average tax return adjusted for inflation was $4,100. So the average tax return is showing $4,100 of capital gains. Now, of course, people at the top end of the income scale are showing a lot more than $4,100, maybe even into the several hundred million dollar range if you start getting into wealthy hedge fund managers or even $1 billion. And there's a lot of people in the bottom end that are showing zero or some nominal amount from interest in their checking account. But the average out is $4,100 per person, and the blue line is just the nominal number, not inflation adjusted, which was $600 billion. So capital gains, the stock market goes up. The byproduct of the stock market going up is it balances the budget or gets the budget closer to balancing. And I've said I've seen analysis, and I have no reason to believe it wrong, and it makes sense, that if the stock market were to go up another 10 to 15%, I used to say 15 to 20, but we've already had a 10% gain, so it's now another 10 to 15% by the end of next year, 18 more months, and hold that level through the end of 08, and you don't have any major change in spending patterns in Washington, no other big hurricane to spend $100 billion in cleaning up or a terrorist attack or some other move in Iraq or anything else that would require a lot of money, or Congress just starts spending money like drunken sailors. Let's assume that everything that we know about spending stays steady, and you get another 15% gain in the stock market and hold it through the end of next year, George Bush can leave office with a balanced budget, which a lot of people think is still impossible to happen, but we've already whacked $300 billion off of it. Thank you, stock market. So the stock market is very, very important to Washington, and they're just now starting to understand that. Page 9. Just to kind of talk about the stock market's influence one more time, I just want to point out that we've been very critical of the consumer confidence surveys because we don't think they tell anything new, because they line up very closely with the stock market. They are highly correlated with it. The question is too abstract. People don't understand it. So when you ask them, what do you think the state of the economy is, that's like asking somebody, what's the weather like in the United States? I don't know. It's raining in some places. It's sunny in other places. So they look out the window and tell you what the weather is. When you ask them what the state of the economy is, they don't know, so they just describe what the stock market did last month, which is why consumer confidence indexes line up with the stock market. Again, a very, very tight correlation. So the stock market, even if you're watching the stock market go up and you don't trade stocks, it affects the budget deficit, it affects consumer confidence, it affects what people think about the economy, and therefore it affects interest rates. Finally, on page 10, and on page 11, I just want to make a few comments about foreign activity and treasuries, because this is another one of these stories that seems to be on the tip of everybody's tongue. There was a Business Week story 2 weeks ago, what if foreign money shunned the U.S.? It was interesting because the story brought up a point that we've brought up in the past. That is, let's look at the example from 03 and 04 with Japan. If you look at the top chart, the bars represent official purchases of treasuries from Japan, and the line represents official purchases of treasuries by all official institutions or central banks. So the blue line is all central banks. The bars are Japan. They don't break it out by central bank per country, so I can't give you Japan's central bank. But what you can see in this chart is, can we make the assumption, and I think it's a very safe assumption, that the big bulge in Japanese buying that corresponded with the big rise up and down with central bank activity was all the Bank of Japan. And by being all of the Bank of Japan, we could make the case, okay, what happens if there's a $200 billion shift in foreign buying or selling of treasuries? Well, the answer is it happened a couple of years ago. You could see, now remember that the 10-year yield bottomed at 3.11 in June of 03. Find June of 03 on this chart, and you will see that the Japanese were net buyers on a year-over-year basis of about $50 billion worth of treasuries. They then bought about $250 billion annualized, or in total. In other words, their buying reached a peak of $250 billion year-over-year, and in total bought almost $400 billion worth of treasuries by the end of 04. They bought $400 billion by the end of 04. What did interest rates do during that period? They rose. They rose because the economy was heating up. They rose because the Fed was raising rates, and there was a rise, at least in early 04, in anticipation of that. So Let's turn it around. What if they rushed in and threw $400 billion at our market? Well, they did a couple of years ago, and rates went up. Then they stopped. Then you can see we went from a year-over-year basis of $250 billion by November of 2004 to early 2006, about a year ago. They were net sellers of $30 billion. $250 billion worth of Treasury buying stopped. And you can see that that was largely the Bank of Japan because the official institution line dialed quite a bit. What happened to interest rates when they stopped? They went down. So one of the things we've been talking about with this obsession of what happens when the Chinese stop buying treasuries or what happens when the Chinese economy slows, and, well, they only own $400 billion to begin with. The Japanese added and subtracted those kind of numbers or added that kind of level and then stopped. And we didn't see any movement out of interest rates on it. So I think, one, we vastly overestimate what the effects of foreign buying is. Now, I agree, and I've been on the case, that foreigners own about 50% of our treasuries, and that means that all things being equal, they're depressing our interest rates. There's no doubt about that. But to look at jiggles in the margins about whether or not they're buying here or selling there and saying that that's going to have a profound impact on interest rates, I think vastly overstates the case. And we can use as an example just a couple of years ago with the Japanese. Page 11, this is a chart we put together for a report we put out a couple of days ago called our Treasury International Capital Update. I found it fascinating. I didn't know this. Everybody I've showed this to didn't really understand this as well either. So I thought it would be one important to understand that foreign flows, those that are in favor of global capital markets will be heartened to see these charts. Net purchases of U.S. securities by all foreign countries, the top left chart, is at a new record. The net purchase of U.S. securities is at about $1.1 trillion year-over-year basis. So in the last year, foreigners bought about $1 trillion worth of U.S. securities. They have not actually had a net outflow of U.S. securities since September of 98. So all that fear about, well, what happens if they sell, they haven't actually had 1 month of outflows for about 9 years right now. But if you look at the chart on the right, this is the opposite. The net purchase of all foreign stocks and bonds by the U.S., so how much are we buying of foreign securities? That's at a record, too. So the amount of money coming into the country by foreigners is at a record. The amount of money going out of the country by Americans is a record. Now, admittedly, the U.S. numbers are much smaller. They're only about $275 billion on a year-over-year basis. But nevertheless, we're both heading higher. Money coming in, money going out, big two-way flows when it comes to foreign activity. If you look at the bottom charts, it breaks it down with the stocks versus bonds. If you look at what foreigners are buying of the U.S., the bars are fixed income assets. It's almost all fixed income assets. It's about $1 trillion of fixed income assets. It's about $150 billion worth of equities. If you look at what U.S. investors are buying of foreign securities, it's about evenly split. I say about because the red line shows equities, and the blue line shows bars, and up until 2 months ago, actually there was more equity buying than fixed income buying, and that's kind of flip-flop, but it's about equal numbers, roughly, whereas it is not about equal numbers the other way. So foreigners buy $1 trillion worth of U.S., almost all fixed income. That's a record. The U.S. sends $275 billion overseas. That's a record, about evenly split between fixed income and equity. So the flows, when we look at flows, I just thought it was interesting to note that the flows are records going both directions. And this idea that we were talking about, what if foreigners shun U.S. securities? What if the Chinese start selling? You could not possibly pick a more incorrect time to ask that question because exactly the opposite is happening, that more money is coming into the U.S. and the U.S. investors are sending more money overseas. The confidence in the global financial system has never been higher because money's coming in records and money is leaving here in records. To ask that question should at least premise that this is what's happening. Confidence in the global financial system has never been higher, and the flows both ways are records. So before we start fretting about what it means if it stops, give me a credible reason for why you think it will stop now. Because the trends, if you look at this chart, have been unmistakable for years, that the flows, the two-way flows, have been increasing. So just from history, now is not the time to just from history, now is not the time to start looking for those flows to change and go the other way. Okay. With that as a backdrop on Fed policy, the stock market, international capital flows, I will stop there. I will ask Gene, the operator, to come back online and give you guys directions on how to ask questions. So, Gene, are you there?
Ladies and gentlemen, at this time we will conduct the question and answer session. If you would like to state a question, please press star 1 on your phone now, and you will be placed in the queue in the order received, or press pound at any time to remove yourself from the queue. Please listen for your first name only to be announced and be prepared to ask your question when prompted. We are now ready to begin. Once again, go ahead.
All I was going to say was, as usual, you can also email me questions at jbianco, J-B-I-A-N-C-O, at biancoresearch.com. For some reason, that seems to be a popular way also for people to ask questions. And I've already got my first email question, which actually came in before the conference call. So while people are getting into the queue, let me answer that question. And I'll also remind you, we only use first names only on the questions because we feel by keeping it somewhat anonymous encourages questions. So Jason asked a question about the VIX in the move. The recent trend in the move has been to continue downward while the VIX has been uptrending since mid-April. Do you think of this has any significance? First of all, let me give a quick description to everybody what we're talking about. The VIX, the volatility index, the stock market shot up when the stock market went down in late February, early March. It is stabilized. The VIX is stabilized around 13.5 or so. I would probably tend to describe what it's done since mid-April or the last month is more sideways action around the 13 level or so, as opposed to having some kind of level up or down. The MOVE index, the Merrill Option Volatility Index, or implied volatility in the bond market, has collapsed in recent days, and it's now at a new all-time low. Volatility is the price of insurance, and you need insurance when there is uncertainty. Let me take the move first. It's at an all-time low. Does that mean that the market is very comfortable with the level of interest rates? I think it does. I think that just like I started off the conference call, why am I not talking about the curve and why am I not talking about interest rates? Because the curve's minus 2. It has been minus 2 for a year. That means sometimes it gets to positive 7 and sometimes it gets to minus 12, and we're now to the point where we think that there's a difference between minus 2 and positive 3, that somehow minus 2 means one thing for the economy and positive 3 means another thing for the economy. Ridiculous as that sounds, that's exactly the analysis we're getting because we're counting the basis points one at a time, thinking that there's some kind of importance there. The 10-year note's at 473 right now. It's been at 470, 460 something now for weeks. I think that that's going to continue to be at those levels. Curve's going to be slightly negative. 10-year's going to be somewhere around 470. Everybody knows what the Fed is doing. Everybody knows what the Bank of Japan is doing. The economy's running at around 2%. Nobody's making a case for an upward or downward move in the economy. Why do we need insurance in this market when everything is known and nothing is happening, hence the move at an all-time low? You are correct if you're thinking, well, then that means that there's going to be a surprise somewhere because we've built in too much complacency. That is a valid way to look at it. But to answer the question, why is the move so low, I think it's because everybody knows that what's happening and nothing is moving. Kind of hard to get all excited about the curve unless you really want to say that I forecast that the curve will go to positive 3 or minus 8 as opposed to being 2/10 at minus 2 as if that's a different number. The VIX, there is an investor skew in stocks because naturally investors are long stocks, which isn't the same in currencies or in fixed income. So given that skew, there's a high degree of correlation between the stock market and the level of the VIX. Rallying stocks tend to get lower VIXs and declining stocks get higher VIXs. We saw that in late February when the market went down, the VIX shot up. So why isn't the VIX returning to 13? Why isn't the VIX returning to that 10 level or so that it was at before February 27th? Why is it settling at 13? Uncertainty. Is everybody comfortable with the rally in the stock market? I'd argue they're not as comfortable with this rally as they were with the rally that we had prior to February 27th. Hence, the need for insurance and the higher levels of the VIX index. I think that those, you know, sometimes the simplest answers are the best. I think those are the answers of what's been happening with volatility. As far as do I think these have any significance, probably the MOVE index has more significance only in that whenever you get to all-time lows in volatility, it suggests a high degree of investor complacency. If the market's so complacent, I'm not even talking about interest rates on this call. So therefore, the chances are very good that we could see a surprise in the marketplace that could really move the market. Now, I don't know what that surprise would be. If I was to start giving you reasons, I'd be just guessing. But I'd say maybe if you wanted to look at that as a yellow or a caution flag, that would be a proper way to look at it. So let me stop there with Jason's question about the VIX and the move and ask Gene, do we have any call-in questions?
Yes, our first question comes from Michael. Please state your question.
Hi, Jim. I have several, actually. I'll just ask one for now. The point that you make about that net purchases of U.S. securities of about $1 trillion roughly and net purchases of foreign securities by U.S. Investors of about 275, it seems to me that the difference between those two is just about equal to the trade deficit. And my question to you, isn't that an identity? In other words, if the trade deficit is $800 billion or some such number, isn't it necessarily so excuse me, that those dollars have to wind up in somebody's hands and are temporarily invested in, for example, T-bills or T-notes and therefore show up as if they were investment? But is it maybe going too far to take that as confidence in the U.S. systems by our trade creditors?
The answer to your question, yes. I mean, ultimately, these are the numbers that you would look at, that net and various other nets like it, to say that that's why the large current account balance of the trade deficit has frustrated those that think that the dollar should be collapsing off of that news, because we could run the big trade deficit or current account deficit forever as long as everybody continues to give us money. Like I said in my comment, I agree with you that it would be a mistake to say that this means that there's total confidence in the system forever. There's confidence in the system now, hence the big two-way flows. That does not mean that something can't happen to upset that confidence. And I think that those that want to talk about what if foreigners shun the U.S., that's a valid question. But instead of talking about the consequences of them shunning the U.S., let's leave that as the second part. Why would they shun it now? That the year-over-year flows, according to the TIC data, which goes back to the year-over-year flows that go back to 1978, have never shown a year-over-year outflow by foreigners all the way back to 1978. They've never net sold the market for 30 years. Why do we think that that is a concern now? That is a better question to ask. So, yeah, I mean, whenever I see people saying, all right, there's a lot of confidence in the system, I understand there is now, but I also understand that do not assume that it will be that way forever. Michael, did you have a follow-up on that?
Well, again, I mean, I'm a little hung up on the identity issue here. Even if foreigners did not have confidence and were changing dollars wholesale into euros, for example, or at central bank levels or elsewhere, somewhere there would be dollars which would be short-term, which would forcibly be invested short-term into a yield-bearing instrument and presumably show up as investments in the U.S. for those who want to interpret it that way. But in a sense, I'm not sure what to read into that other than we export huge amounts of paper. It comes back in some form because the holders have to do something with it.
Mm-hmm. I agree with you that you could see that in the bottom charts, that the vast majority of foreign investment into the U.S. is in fixed income. It's being parked. There's no doubt it's being parked in yield-bearing instruments while the resolution of what to do with that money is decided elsewhere, where the U.S. investment you can actually argue is more a little bit more in what we would consider investment, because it's more equity driven and it's more more speculative driven. Meaning not more speculative, but meaning that they're investing in capital and plant and equipment, U.S. investors overseas, by buying more equities. 50% almost is being bought of equities, whereas we are seeing the numbers, at least from foreigners, being parked in treasuries, and we're seeing it being parked in short-term instruments. Like I said, I'm not going to say that, you know, that the system is perfect and there's not a problem. I'm just saying that no one perceives a problem now, and these high flows are evidence that no one perceives a problem right now, the flows both in and out of the U.S. Michael, if you got any other questions, give me a call after the conference call or an email, but I want to move on.
Sure.
I got another email question from Ben, and Ben gives me an interesting statistic here. The bottom 350 companies in the S&P 500 account for $3.6 trillion, or 26% of the $13.8 trillion market cap of the S&P 500. So that kind of gives you an idea. When Cramer makes that statement that there's enough money in private equity to buy the 350 bottom companies in the S&P 500, that would mean about $3.5 trillion. Is that the total amount of private equity with the total amount, I assume that Cramer's statement is, the total amount of private equity, assuming that they apply leverage numbers like the typical private equity firm, have the capacity to buy about $3.5 trillion worth of equities, which would be the 350 bottom S&P 500 firms. Thanks, Ben, for that stat. Very interesting. Gene, do we have any other calls?
If you would like to state a question, please press star 1 on your phone now. Yes, our next question comes from Richard. Please state your question.
Okay. The first quarter GDP, I guess, was 1.2. Maybe it'll be revised down to 0.7, and yet the unemployment rate's at 4.445. And you said that the Fed is looking at inflation and employment. They're not looking. Are they looking at employment as a proxy for GDP, or could we get a? I mean, if we had two quarters or three quarters of 2% GDP growth, but inflation remained where it is, for whatever demographic reasons, would that be acceptable to them?
Well, that gets into a philosophical debate about where the Fed is in its thinking. If you believe, I would argue this, 1.3% growth, first quarter GDP, stock market's at an all-time high, the employment rate is very low, the inflation rate is a little bit above their target range. As long as I would say in order of importance, I would probably give you a guess that the inflation rate being above their target range is the most important thing in influencing them, so they're on hold. The next most important thing that's going to influence them is going to be their forecast on the employment on the core inflation rate, which they believe is going to moderate, which then puts them on hold. I would argue that the third most important thing would probably be a sign of confidence in the stock market or in the economy and the financial system. And the stock market being at all-time highs puts them on hold. And the fourth most important thing would be lousy GDP, which would suggest an ease. So if the GDP numbers continue to run weak, like we saw in the first quarter, I would argue that in order to get the Fed to get off of this move, they would need to see the inflation rate come down a lot. They would need to forecast, and Bernanke would tell us, because he tells us in his speeches, he's very clear-spoken on this, that they are forecasting big drops in the inflation rate, maybe a weakening in the equity market. Then GDP would start to affect Fed policy. But right now, it's just being overwhelmed. It's being overwhelmed by the unemployment rate. It's being overwhelmed by the stock market. It's being overwhelmed by high core inflation. And it's being overwhelmed by a Fed that is only predicting modest declines in high core inflation. So there's really nothing out there. Your argument, just to reiterate my point at the beginning, is exactly the way Greenspan looked at it. But I'm arguing this is not Greenspan. This is a different guy who looks at it in a different way. And the personality of the Fed chairman does matter. And his personality and his way of looking at it is very different. Dick, did you have a follow-up to that?
No, that was excellent. Thank you.
Okay, thanks. Gene, do we have any other questions?
At this time, there are no further questions.
Okay. We've been on this call for 46 minutes. I will wrap it up unless somebody hits one to give us a question in the next 5 seconds. I will be available in the office afterwards. And for anybody who's got any other questions or comments, thank you all for attending this conference call, and we will see you at next month's call.
This concludes today's conference call. Thank you for attending.